RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Michael Connett is a partner at Siri Glimstad and the lead attorney in Food and Water Watch versus EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. It's a landmark US federal court case at the end of last year, and many of you who listen to RCR will know about this, challenging water fluoridation. Michael argued that fluoridation poses serious health risks, particularly to children. His efforts led to the first ever federal risk assessment, acknowledging fluoridation as an unreasonable risk and ordering the EPA to take action. He has come to New Zealand through Fluoride Free NZ to conduct a speaking tour about the significant harms fluoride poses to human health and the implications if our councils are forced to add it. Michael Connett, welcome to New Zealand and thanks for coming on RCR.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
Now, can you recap, firstly, just to set the table, what damage does fluoride do to human health?
So there's several key concerns. The first, in our lawsuit, we focused on one of those concerns, which is the impact on the brain. And our case focused particularly on the developing brain from exposures in utero and in early infancy. But there are a number of other serious chronic health concerns with fluoride exposure, including bone fragility. We know from animal studies and even human clinical experiments that fluoride reduces the strength of bone. There's no question about it. Fluoride accumulates in the bone, and if you get too much in there, your bones will be weaker and more vulnerable to fracture. So bone fracture is a serious concern with fluoride exposure. We're also concerned about arthritis, so chronic joint pain. Again, Paul, there's no dispute that fluoride can cause chronic joint pain. It's still only a question of what is the dose and how does that dose vary based on someone's individual susceptibility. There are also concerns with fluoride's impact on the thyroid gland. In 2006, the National Research Council in the United States concluded that fluoride is an endocrine disrupting compound. And so there is concerns about sort of broader endocrine effects that fluoride may cause. So those are some of, I would say, the key concerns with chronic long-term fluoride exposure.
Are there obvious signs of these problems that you've just outlined? I mean, I automatically, when you mention bone density, I know many elder women who have this problem. So that was the first thing that caught my ear.
Well, the thing that's obvious, Paul, right off the bat, is we know by looking at children's teeth that kids are receiving too much fluoride. And we know that because many children today now show signs of dental fluorosis, which is a disorder of the tooth enamel caused by too much fluoride exposure early in life. In the United States, the latest national study, which was conducted in 2015 and 2016, found that 68% of US children now have some form of dental fluorosis. And the teeth have sometimes been referred to as the shop window to the bones, because the impact of fluoride on the mineralized tissue of teeth is similar to the impact that it can have on the bones. Now, health authorities, including in the United States and New Zealand, have chronically failed to take their responsibility seriously to monitor the effects of fluoride on the general population. So we don't have the type of data that we should have to understand the current extent of fluoride's impact on bone health. But what we do know, Paul, is there are studies, including a very well done study in 2021 from Sweden, which have found that communities with even low levels of fluoride, like one part per million in the water, there have been significant associations with hip fracture in the elderly. Now, all studies have found that effect because a lot of the studies actually have methodological limitations that make it harder to detect the association between fluoride and bone fracture. But we have a number of studies that have found significant correlations between fluoride and hip fracture which, as you know, Paul, is a very serious health condition for an elderly person, which can lead to permanent loss of independence and, for some people, death. And again, the government, including in New Zealand, has completely failed to take their obligation seriously to protect the public from fluoride's harms. They're not studying the issue. And all they do is just tell people it's safe over and over and over again. But simply telling people this is safe doesn't make it so. And there needs to be a much more rigorous attempt to monitor the impacts of fluoride.
I've got to ask you this. Do we know if there are any benefits to health from fluoride? Are there?
Well, fluoride, so the key question is, okay, fluoride is obviously added to drinking water for the purpose of preventing tooth decay, right? Mm. But we have to ask ourselves, how does fluoride help the teeth, if it does? And what the science shows is that the beneficial effect of fluoride on teeth in terms of reducing cavities comes overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, from topical contact with the outside of the tooth. So you don't need to swallow fluoride to obtain the only benefit it provides, which contradicts what they used to think. We started fluoridation decades ago on the premise that you do need to swallow fluoride, right? That's why they added it to water. You swallow water. But we now know that's not the case. You don't need to swallow this stuff to get the only benefit it provides. So, Paul, the question becomes, why are we adding a chemical to our water, which, first off, doesn't treat the water? It doesn't make the water safer to drink. The only purpose for adding it to water is to prevent tooth decay, and you don't even need to swallow it to get that benefit. Today, we should be moving away from water fluoridation, and for those people who want to use fluoride for oral health, it's much more rational and much safer to use it in the form of toothpaste, where you put it on the tooth and you spit it out.
When it comes to informed consent, there's no way of getting to any sort of level of informed consent when it's in the water supply.
That is absolutely right, which is one of the reasons why most of Europe has rejected fluoridation, because Europe wisely concluded that the water supply is not an appropriate way to deliver medical treatment, because it takes away each individual's right, which is a well-cherished right in medicine, of the individual to have choice, to have the informed choice of whether or not to use a medical treatment. When you add it to water, you deprive people of that choice. And there's no reason, no compelling reason whatsoever, to deprive people of this choice on fluoride exposure, because we have so many fluoride products now available. They're not expensive. They're at every single grocery store in New Zealand. It's in a tube of toothpaste. If you want to use fluoride, that is the way to use it, not by adding it to everybody's water supply.
I noted yesterday during the RFK hearings in Congress, he brought up fluoride. It was a quick mention, but he brought it up, which kind of made me feel this is mainstream. I knew it was going mainstream anyway, but to have that said. And I mention that because we had a High Court ruling last year, as you probably know, which found fluoridation directives unlawful. Yet councils, and we'll get to your meeting with the council in just a moment, proceeded under severe threat of penalties from our Director General of Health. Why do you think health authorities are so wedded to fluoride? They really can't let it go. Why is that?
Well, it's a very good question. And frankly, I wish I had better answer for you, because I ask myself, why are we still compelling people to consume something in their water that they don't need to ingest, that doesn't have really any benefit by ingesting it? Why are we still forcing people to consume this in their water when it's now linked to effects on the brain, to neurotoxicity? Why are we forcing people to drink this when it's linked to chronic impacts on the bones, to leading to bone weakness and arthritis? So I don't have a good answer other than, you know, medical orthodoxies, and water fluoridation is certainly a medical orthodoxy, can die hard. institutions that have pushed this for so long in such aggressive ways, it can be hard to turn to change course. And so I think we see that with water fluoridation, where you have these institutions that really are kind of fossilized in a very outdated framework on fluoride. But I do think, Paul, and I am optimistic that we're going to start seeing changes there, and that we're going to start seeing water fluoridation, be let go and move away from it, I think, moving forward.
You're here on a speaking tour, but you're talking to, well, you've talked to one or with one council, councillors at Whangarei, and rejected the order to fluoridate their water system, and at the start of the year, don't quite know where they're at. Maybe you can give us more of an update because you've had a fresh conversation with them. Take us through that meeting with them. What were your impressions?
Well, clearly the Whangarei Council is dealing with a very difficult issue. The Ministry of Health has threatened to sue Whangarei if they do not begin fluoridating their water by, I think, March 30th of this year. And at that time, the ministry has threatened to sue them an initial amount of $200,000. And then for every day thereafter, sue them $10,000 a day if for as long as they don't fluoridate their water. So I think, Paul, this really underscores the absolute evisceration of informed consent. You're literally forcing people. The government is trying to force Whangarei to do this under the threat of, kind of crippling fines. Like, how does the government think that that is in the best interest of Whangarei citizens to basically impoverish the community by fining them $10,000 a day? Under what conception of the public interest does that come within, to force people by threat of daily fines that could be crippling if they don't fluoridate their water? So this, I think, it just highlights that water fluoridation is a policy backed by force that deprives the individual, that deprives the community of this cherished right of medical choice.
Also, our national politicians at national level have been very quiet about this issue. And it's always fascinated me, the connection between the health bureaucrats and politicians. Seems to me, and many others, that the politicians kind of take their orders from the bureaucrats. We talked about informed consent and the impossibility of rising to that level. That's so obvious. It's a human rights issue at the end. What you've just said is absolutely correct. You're basically making the locals pay to poison themselves, regardless if they want it or not. You got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that you do have, I think, here a situation where it is the bureaucracy that is running the show, and I think that these are unelected officials, and so have less accountability to the public. I would hope that some of the national politicians would intervene here and really press upon the unelected bureaucracy to be mindful of the public's desire and interest here. You know, the people deserve to have a say about what drugs they use, and they certainly have a right to say what drugs are added to their drinking water. And I think it's important and imperative for the elected officials at the national level to push back upon the unelected bureaucracy on this issue. You know, it's time for change. It's, looking at fluoride from a sort of Cold War 1950s perspective, where one dose fits all, and it's just so outdated, so oversimplified, and it's time for change.
And that's in the face of, well, last time I went to the supermarket, I'll see two or three people walking out with multiple large bottles of soda drinks, sugared soda drinks. And I'm not sure of the actual numbers, pretty sure that lower socio shoppers, let's say, do consume these products in vast quantities, yet they are, that group is cited as the group that we're trying to save from tooth decay. Again, nothing ever said about that. It stands out like a sore thumb. I guess that's another domino that needs to fall, is it?
Right. Well, I think this kind of speaks in part, Paul, to some of the historic politics that have been in the background on the fluoride issue. Because if you go back all the way to the 1940s, when water fluoridation first began, you will find that the sugar industry was very involved in funding some of the early research on fluoride, as well as promoting the use of fluoride as a way to tackle our tooth decay problems. And the sugar industry clearly has an interest here, right? Because the sugar industry doesn't want to see a crackdown or further restrictions on sugary products, right? And so the notion that you can kind of put this cheap industrial poison in the drinking water and fix our tooth decay problems is very attractive to the sugar industry. But the policymakers should certainly be taking a broader view on this and shouldn't just be looking at it from that vantage point. And I think, Paul, it's, you know, one of the things that really concerns me a lot, and I discussed this yesterday during my presentation before the Whangarei Council, is, you know, targeting low-income communities with water fluoridation is dangerous and very misguided, because it is in low-income communities that you see this, the types of factors that increase susceptibility to fluoride's toxic effects. Things like nutrient deficiencies or suboptimal nutrient intake, calcium, vitamin D, protein, as well as increased rates of kidney disease, dialysis. These are the types of factors that make people more vulnerable to suffering harm from fluoride exposure. And so targeting low-income communities with water fluoridation, not only are you, you know, not only are these communities less able to filter the fluoride out of their water, but they have some of the susceptibilities that we need to be concerned about when it comes to fluoride and health.
I think it's fair to say that apart from Fluoride Free NZ, have been relentless on this for years. And the reporting we've done here at RCR with Alistair Harding's series, which included you, and the interviews that we've done regarding fluoride over the last 2 years here at RCR, in the mainstream media, there's been little to no reporting of the information to come out of the case that you led, re the dangers of fluoride, re health. Indeed, when I have discussions and debates on fluoride, and I'm reasonably well informed now with circles of friends and others, I'm finding it very hard to persuade them that there are health downsides to fluoride despite the information that's out there. So there's still a bit of work to do there, right?
Yes, I think there is. And I do think certainly in the United States, since the ruling came out last fall, we have seen a level of media interest on the fluoride issue that we've never seen before. And part of that is a result of Robert Kennedy making the fluoride issue part of the Make America Healthy Again movement. So I have been encouraged to see that fluoride is getting, at least in the United States, much more attention than it has in the past. And hopefully we'll see something similar here in New Zealand.
I believe the EPA are appealing the case. The ruling, is that what's happening?
That is correct. The EPA, in the last days of the Biden administration, announced that they do intend to appeal the court's order. However, the incoming administration, or now the current administration, the Trump administration, has the authority, if it so chooses, to withdraw that appeal. And I think if Robert Kennedy is confirmed as the secretary of the Health and Human Services Department, that, you know, I'm hopeful that that will carry over to a change in policy at the EPA as well. So there's nothing about the Biden administration's decision that in any way binds what the current administration can do.
Michael, if any of our health bureaucrats or politicians are listening to this chat right now, what would you say to them?
My message would be, this is not about whether you, this is not about fluoride itself. This is not about whether to ban fluoride. This is about how do we use fluoride safely and effectively, okay? And so this is not about depriving a single person of fluoride if they so choose or want to use it. And today, based on the current science, it is, you know, as a matter of logic, rationality, safety, and efficacy, using fluoride in individual topical products like toothpaste is far wiser and a far better approach to the use to using fluoride than adding it to everybody's drinking water. So we really need to be, I think, following the path of Europe, which has already essentially done this. Europe does not, for the vast majority, does not add it to their water. They have fluoride available in toothpaste. And by taking that approach, you respect every family and individual's choice on whether they want to use fluoride or not. And so I think that is, I would just really emphasize that. This is not about taking away people's, if people want to use fluoride, it's right there in the grocery store. It's not expensive. It's easy to get. But we shouldn't be forcing people to ingest it, because ingesting fluoride is where the risks come. And I would say that an unnecessary risk, water fluoridation at this point presents unnecessary risks. We do not need to swallow it. And an unnecessary risk is an unacceptable risk, particularly when you are forcing someone to take that risk against their will. So let us respect choice, and by respecting choice, we're actually going to be using fluoride in a safer and more effective way.
Michael Conant, lead attorney in Food and Water Watch versus EPA, thank you for coming on RCR. We will give out the dates and times and venues of your speaking tour right after this interview, and maybe we'll chat again before you've left the country.
Well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
And Michael Conant's speaking schedule as follows: Whangarei, Saturday 1st Feb, 3 p.m. Old Library, Rust Avenue. Auckland, February 2, Sunday, 3:30 p.m. Hillsborough Room, Fickling Convention Centre. Tauranga, Monday 3rd Feb, 7 p.m. Tapuna Memorial Hall. Rotorua, Tuesday 4th Feb, 7 p.m. Conference Room 5, Millennium Hotel. Cambridge, Wednesday 5th Feb, 7 p.m. Main Hall, Cambridge Town Hall. Hastings, Friday 7th Feb, 7 p.m. Havelock North Function Centre. Palmerston North, Saturday 8 Feb, 3 p.m. Church on Vogel, 127 Vogel Street. And in Wellington, Monday 10th of Feb, 7 p.m. Law School, Victoria University, Papatia Campus.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.